Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Howdy, we are back. Had a medical emergency for our guest yesterday, so had to cancel. Sorry about that. First time ever. We wish Ms. Buzz Patterson a get well soon and Godspeed. We'll hopefully reschedule that soon. I am still Steve Abramowitz, and this is the Heartland Journal's Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. Welcome to our People in the News, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with special guest Secretary of State of the great state of Tennessee, Trey Hargett. Trey Hargett was elected by the Tennessee General Assembly to serve as Tennessee's 37th Secretary of State in 2009 and re-elected in 13, 17, and 21. Secretary Hargett is the Chief Executive Officer of the Department of State with oversight of more than 300 employees. He also serves on numerous boards and commissions, on two of which he is the presiding member. The services and oversight found in the Secretary of State's office reach every department and agency in state government. Under Secretary Hargett's leadership, the department has implemented a massive overhaul of its technological abilities to embrace customers online. The department offers Tennesseans online voter registration and the Go Vote Tennessee mobile app, Go Vote TN mobile app, to help increase voter registration, turnout, and awareness. We do have a turnout issue. A redesigned website found at sos.tn.gov offers a wealth of information and services, including an intuitive online corporate filing system, a place where consumers can learn how their charitable contributions are being spent, and resources to promote civic engagement across Tennessee. He also continues to promote the vast resources of the Tennessee State Library and Archives. Thanks to his work with the Tennessee General Assembly, the Library and Archives recently moved to a new facility on the Bicentennial Mall, where it can better serve all Tennesseans while preserving the state's history. Secretary Hargett was named a Council of State Government's Henry Toll Fellow in 2010, an honor given annually to 48 of the nation's top state government officials. Additionally, he is on the board of directors of the YMCA, Center for Civic Engagement, or was a member of the, you can tell me if you still are, a member of the Union University Advisory Board, as well as chairman of the Executive Committee of the Republican Secretaries of State Committees, NSSC. Secretary Hargett is also a graduate of the Aspen Institute, Rodale Fellowship Class of 2010. He has also been recognized for his support of National History Day. Previously, he served as chairman of the Tennessee Regulatory Authority. Before joining the Tennessee Regulatory Authority, he was regional vice president for a publicly traded emergency services provider. Secretary Hargett served in the Tennessee House of Representatives for a decade, representing District 97, Bartlett, and Memphis, and was twice elected Republican leader by his colleagues. Mr. Hargett earned a BBA in accounting with honors from Memphis State University, as well as an MBA from the University of Memphis. A native of Ripley, Secretary Hargett now lives in Hendersonville with his wife, Dawn, and their two sons. He is a Southern Baptist and attends Indian Lake Peninsula Church. Secretary Hargett is the son of Pat Vaughn of Wingo, Kentucky, and retired Major General Gus Hargett, Jr. of Murfreesboro. Wow, that is a distinguished introduction. Hello, Secretary Hargett. How are you today?
Fine. I tell you, though, I got to shorten that bio way back, so I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Not possible. That's you earned every line on that. So good for you for being a civil servant, as we say, a civic-minded servant. So tell us, when you got voted in 2019, Tennessee, that was before voting machines, internet, really, and digital ballots, were things better or worse? Are things better or worse for voting in Tennessee now?
Well, that's a great question. You know, as you stated, I was elected Secretary of State in 2009 for the first time, when Republicans gained the majority in state legislature. And I'm now in year 16 of my tenure. And the first 8 years, honestly, elections seemed to be fairly controversy-free in Tennessee and across the nation. You know, of course, that was still post-Bush-Gore recount in Florida. And so we've had our share in our country, but you know, in 2016, whenever then President Obama said he was concerned about the security of our elections, and later candidate Trump during that same cycle said he thought that the election might be rigged if he didn't win. And so that's kind of carried forward. And so the last 7+ years, we have a lot of people out there who have a lot of doubts about election. And we're fortunate in Tennessee that we've been ranked number one in election integrity by the Heritage Foundation for the last 2 years. Anticipate we'll be number one again this year. And there's a lot of things that go into that. So I just tell people in Tennessee, we want every vote to be counted once, no more, no less. We want to be a place where it's easy to vote and hard to cheat. And we want to make sure that when the election is said and done, if your person won, your person lost, you can have confidence in the results of those elections. Because ultimately, if you don't have confidence in the results of those elections, then that causes an erosion in public confidence in government itself. And that's at the very foundation of our form of government. So, you know, we take that seriously day in and day out. It's not something that we wake up every couple of years and say, oh, it's an election year, let's get to work. It's something that requires ongoing effort, always trying to stay ahead of those who would try to diminish the integrity of our elections, because the bad guys only have to be wrong once, and we got to be right every day.
That's right. I want to talk more about the Heritage in a minute, but I want to you know, mention, of course, that if we trust the state with our taxpayer dollars, they should trust us with the vote, that type of thing. So this would be a great conversation to have. So let's begin with your background and your path to Secretary of State. First elected in 1996, I think you served 10 years as a member of the Tennessee House of Representatives. You were selected twice by Republican colleagues to act as their caucus leader, holding the position from 2003 to 2005. Very interesting times. In Tennessee, the Secretary of State is elected by joint vote of the Tennessee General Assembly and serves a term of 4 years. You were elected in 2009 by the Tennessee General Assembly. Different makeup of characters back then. In Washington, let's say, that role is elected by the people, which got weird last time when the appointed Secretary of State oversaw his own election. You've been around for both parties to rule, Dems in the 90s and Republicans now. How do you feel the Republicans have handled things versus the Dems?
Well, certainly, I don't try and throw shade on, you know, the opposition party. You know, it certainly feels like, though, that Tennesseans have benefited since Republicans gained control in 2009. We've seen our economy really have a strong upward trajectory. And you know, certainly, I think the legislature's been more responsive overall to the wishes of the people. You know, in trying to lower taxes, lower debt, trying to reform our system of education, whether it's K-12 education or higher education, where in all those areas, we're really on the upward trajectory, and now we're leading the nation. And I think the big thing is that in Tennessee, we've chosen to err on the side of freedom and liberty. You know, when everything else fails, you try and figure out how do we make sure that we leave as much power and responsibility and authority to the individuals for their own lives instead of taking that and getting government involved in it. So I think that's what Republicans have done very well. But I would also caution any party, no matter what state, no matter what party's in control, not to become complacent, to never forget what it was like when you were in the minority, to continue to work hard to represent your fellow, your fellow Tennesseans in this case. And always be prepared and do your homework so that you give your best, because at the end of the day, that's really what Tennesseans deserve, regardless if it's Democrats or Republicans. You just want to make sure that you've sent people here to Nashville who are absolutely doing their best, being thoughtful in how they're casting their votes, the legislation they're proposing, the things that they're doing. And if you keep that first and foremost in mind, it's hard to go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. So the mission statement of Tennessee Secretary of State: our mission is to exceed the expectations of our customers, the taxpayers, by operating at the highest level of accuracy, cost effectiveness, and accountability in a customer-centered environment. I went ahead and Googled my old state, Washington, where producer Steve is sitting. Their agency mission is very different. The Office of the Secretary of State promotes public trust by safeguarding vital government records, documents, publications, and process, preserving the integrity of elections in Washington State, providing the business community and public with easy access to information about corporations and charities, we do that, performing public outreach to improve civic knowledge and participation, leverage technology to improve efficiency and enhance customer service. There's where you start, they finish. Do you see a lot of contrasts between our state and, let's say, a state like Washington in the mission of the Secretary of State's office?
When I hear their mission statement, there's a lot of similarity between their duties and what our duties are. And it sounds to me like they're very much focused on trying to serve their customers, the taxpayers of their state as well. And they really have illuminated the many ways in which they do that, you know, whether it's through public records, whether it's through preservation. And in fact, one of the very first secretaries of state I met after I became the secretary of state here in Tennessee was the Washington Secretary of State, Sam Reed, who we spent a lot of time talking about libraries and archives. That was a real passion of his, and he gave me a lot of advice as I was trying to get a new building here in Tennessee, which had been on the back burner for quite some time. But, you know, in the world of business formations, elections, we regulate charities in Tennessee. There's a lot of different ways that we're working each and every day to try and make sure that we're good stewards of taxpayer dollars, that we're trying to achieve exceptionalism through collaboration and integrity. And it sounds to me like there's a lot of similarities between us and Washington in that regard. You know, your mission statement is supposed to be a guardrail, you know, that you're trying each and every day to be aspirational and to live by that and measure the things that we're doing and think about how we're living up to that mission statement.
Do you think the Tennessee one may be too broadly defined? You know, not that Washington actually does what they say, but generally speaking, is the scope too much beyond elections?
Well, no, I mean, for me, I mean, there's a lot of important things we do. Elections tend to be top of the fold, but when you talk about regulation of businesses and charities, administrative procedures, libraries and archives, records management, the publication of Tennessee Blue Book and all the rules and regulations of state government, you know, there's a lot of things that we do that people may or may not know about, but also serve on 15 different boards and commissions. There's a lot of different things that we do that don't necessarily fit into what, you know, other states might think we do or constituents think we do. You know, we have a Tennessee business trafficking program that we just launched, and I'll be glad to talk more about that later on, our Safe at Home program, you know, our Your Vote Matters program. There's a lot of different ways that we're doing that. And so when we created our mission statement back when I first took office in 2009, one of the things I want to make sure we focused on is not to be limited just to the institutionalization of our department and think about here's all that we do. I want to think about in everything that we do, every customer interaction, how do we give our best in trying to make sure that we are good stewards of taxpayer dollars and taxpayer time, because those are really the two assets that everybody comes to us with when they're our customers.
That's great. All right. So you served as president of the National Association of Secretaries of State, elected in 2013. Before that, you were its treasurer. The National Association of Secretaries of State, which probably most people don't know, NASS, is the oldest nonpartisan professional organization of public officials in the United States. It was founded in 1904 and is composed of the Secretaries of State of U.S. states and territories. You are a member of that. 29 Republicans, 26 Democrats today. There's more than 50 because of the territories, of course. Is there a push there for a one country standard for all 50 states out of DC at NASS that the majority of Secretary of States might be in favor of?
Well, that's a great question. I think the quick answer is no, because I think we accept that that's not going to happen, because we know that elections are under the purview and jurisdiction of the states. And so, you know, if everybody gave me a magic wand and said that all the other states would adopt our standards in Tennessee, believe me, I'd be for that standard, and I think it'll be applied nationally. In fairness to other states, that's not what they've come to expect. You mentioned Washington earlier. Washington is a great example of a state. You know, I mentioned Sam Reed earlier, the former Secretary of State there, and Kim Wyman, who succeeded him. And I believe now Steve Hobbs, who I don't know as well, but have, you know, what I do know about him, I really like. He's a fine person. You know, in Washington, that is a vote by mail state. And they took great pains to make sure they implemented over a period of time, were very thoughtful in how they did it, set their rules and parameters so that everybody understood what the rules of the elections were going into it. So that's important for candidates. That's important for voters, as well as the people who conduct the elections. And so by mail has worked in Washington. You know, whether I agree with the results or not, doesn't really matter. It's worked in Washington. And, you know, the mistakes that we saw in other states is they tried to implement what took Washington years to implement. They tried to do it in a period of just a few short weeks or months during the pandemic. In Tennessee, we're just the opposite of Washington, though. We only have about 2.5% of the people that vote or vote absentee by mail. So we have a lot of people who vote early, but absentee by mail is about 2.5% during a presidential year. And during non-presidential years, it's usually been less than 2%. So we like voting in person. So different states are different, and we have to recognize that. And but I do think there are some things that we would all benefit, you know, from adopting as a standard. You know, I'd like to think that we could all agree at some point that we have to have a real finish line about when all the ballots are in and going to be counted. You know, that's one standard we could adopt. There's other things like photo ID that I would love to see adopted. But, you know, also recognize that maybe some other states, they don't feel as strongly about that. And so I don't think that the federal government should be pushing that down other people's throats. I think that is up to the voters in these states to make sure that their elected officials set up the framework they expect.
Yeah, you mentioned Kim Wyman in Washington State. The other thing that they had is the Electronic Registration Information Center, ERIC, which is a nonprofit organization in the United States whose goal is to improve electoral integrity, they say. Tennessee isn't on the ERIC system, thankfully. Alaska, Texas, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin learned their lesson and are out of it, prevented their folks from joining because it's a scam. Missouri, too. How does Tennessee maintain its independence from these central planning election ideas that you mentioned? And is there pressure put on you to join these co-ops?
You know, so the interesting thing you say there is that, number one, you mentioned how they say this about election integrity. That's also, it's largely that ERIC program is more about voter registration and requiring you to do massive mailouts, which are very expensive across the state, to people that they deem to be eligible, what they call EBUs, eligible but unregistered. And so there's a lot more focus on that than there is the actual integrity piece. You know, I don't feel any pressure.
It's also very expensive to join it.
Yeah, so I don't feel pressure to join just because, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, I answer to the voters of this state. And really, I answer to the legislators that those voters send. And so that hasn't bothered me too much. One of the interesting things that happened is, as you stated, we've never been a member. We looked at it, we considered it, decided not to do it. And then I started getting emails as other states withdrew, asking me why I wouldn't be more like those states and withdraw. And I said, well, how do I withdraw from something I've never been a member of? And so I got emails saying, why don't you follow, you know, why don't you follow Alabama's lead or what have you? And I said, well, maybe they're following my lead. I never was in. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, you got to remember who your customer is. And my customer, while I like my fellow secretaries of state, there's a lot of people across the country who are election officials, election experts. You know, at the end of the day, I want to make sure I take care of my customers here in Tennessee and do it the Tennessee way.
We appreciate that. The Commission on Federal Election Reform was a private bipartisan organization founded in 2004, right before you got there, by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and James A. Baker III, a top official under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, to overcome the flaws brought to light by the electoral uncertainty in Florida in the 2000 United States presidential election and in Ohio, people forget, in the 2004 election. It seems like the statists are using that report more like a playbook or game plan, not on what not to do, but what to do, specifically mail-in voting being the most vulnerable to fraud because of chain of custody, the report says. Would you like to see Tennessee avoid mail-in voting forever?
You know, who knows what forever looks like, honestly. I mean, I think our system works. I mean, I think, in fact, you know, when you look at what other states have been moving toward over the last several years, a lot of states really are trying to make sure that they are running elections with more integrity, and they're trying to model what we're doing, because we don't sacrifice integrity for convenience. So the very first thing is we want to make it as easy to vote as possible, but the last thing we want to do is sacrifice integrity. So, you know, I don't have an issue with mail-in ballots as long as you're verifying signatures, that you don't allow ballot harvesting or trafficking where you allow others to go out and collect ballots from other individuals in Tennessee. You're responsible for your own ballot. I want to give a shout out to our current House Speaker here in Tennessee, Cameron Sexton, who gave us the idea of watermarking our absentee ballots in Tennessee, which is one more way that we prevent counterfeiting of our paper ballots in our great state. So I think there are things that you can do, but I tell you, mail-in balloting, one thing you got to make sure of is I don't think you should ever be in a situation where you just automatically mail ballots to people. I think there's got to be some type of signature verification in there. Do that. I mean, one of the interesting things to me during the pandemic is a lot of places were going to a more massive mail-in balloting. You know, if you Google Paterson, New Jersey, P-A-T, it's one T-E-R-S-O-N, New Jersey, they had a city election up there. And you'll see pictures of apartment complex lobbies that have ballots all strewn all over the floor because the people that those ballots were mailed to have moved on. And those are live ballots just waiting there for somebody else to pick up. And if you're not doing appropriate signature verification on those, then that creates an opportunity for voter fraud and voter mischief. And so we want to make sure that we only send a ballot to someone that we know is who they are, that they live where they say they live, where we have the accurate address for them. We verify that signatures that comes back in. And I think that's what leads Tennesseans to trust in their elections, maybe more than some other places.
Yeah, it was verified that there was one apartment that had 400 registered voters in it in Washington State. And so there was, you know, obviously there are scams. That same panel with Carter Baker made 87 recommendations in all in its 91-page report. Implementation of all suggestions would require congressional action for some measures, as well as a total expected cost of $1.35 billion. A major point was the commission's call for nonpartisan professional and state oversight over elections. That's the camel's nose under the tent, right? The commission came up with the mail in the 2020 election for president during COVID. Did you see this on the NASS? And did you see any pushback when they were trying to do the nationwide vote by mail for COVID?
Well, I'll tell you, in 2016 and then again in 2020, has really caused a lot of friction inside the National Association of Secretaries of State group, to the point where following the 2020 presidential election, I actually left the group for a while and later rejoined because there was a lot of divisiveness. You know, depending on if you're a blue state or a red state, there's a lot of pressure, you know, that, hey, each and every state believed that they absolutely did it the right way and the other states did not do it the right way. So there was a lot of pressure in our group to make sure that, you know, we were respectful of one another. That became hard at times. You know, I had one of my dear friends in a group one day send me a text after then President Trump had made a statement they were offended by, and they said, well, when are you going to stand up to him? And I said, well, I'm still waiting on you to stand up to X, Y, and Z about that. So a lot of raw feelings. You know, at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of really good Democrat secretaries of state out there who I think really are trying to do the best that they can with how their voters expect them to do it. I wish that they would listen to my ideas. They probably wish I would listen to their ideas. And so the key is trying to be respectful and hope that every state at the end of the day is trying to be honest to make sure every vote is counted once, no more, no less. Because unfortunately, whenever another state gets it wrong, then we in our other states start getting pounded with emails and phone calls, you know, from people saying, well, if they're getting it wrong, you must be too. And so it only takes one bad apple to spoil the bunch. And even sometimes maybe not a bad apple, but a suspected bad apple to cast doubt over the entire election.
For every Florida and Tennessee that got it right, there was a Georgia and an Arizona that got it very, very wrong. A little bit more on election integrity. So when it comes to EI, everyone has now deferred to this heritage.org survey that nobody had ever heard of 5 years prior, but they ranked Tennessee number one, and it's good to be number one, but there are no perfect elections in all the 50 states, as we found out, and we are the best of them, but we got a zero and a one on two of the criteria. So just a little wonkiness, you know, we got the 90 score out of 100, out of 14 categories, for example, a perfect 4 to 4 in vote harvesting/trafficking restrictions, Okay, a leftist group might say 4 to 4 is an F, but Heritage gave us an A for that particular category. Okay, so we got a 0 out of 3 for election litigation procedures, which broke down was 0 out of 1 for the state legislature has standing to sue statutorily or via state constitution to ensure compliance with election laws as passed by the legislature. Any changes to the state's election law via a court settlement required the approval of the state legislature. Residents of the state have standing to sue election officials who do not abide by state election laws. General standing to contest the results of an election is not sufficient for purposes of this question. I'm not a big fan of lawyers and lawfare to win elections, but what do you say about 0 out of 3, or I guess all no's to those 4 questions for election litigation procedures category?
Yeah, so great. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. Of course, we're thrilled to still be number one, always looking for areas of improvement. You know, I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree that everything that Heritage has in those sections is necessary. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that was suggested was that a state legislator should have the ability to bring a lawsuit, who would have standing and bring a lawsuit regarding election laws, change election laws, court decisions, et cetera. Well, you know, as the Republican Secretary of State, and more importantly, Tennessee Secretary of State, one of the concerns I have is all it would take is one legislator, no matter how extreme on either side, to be able to go and have standing to file a suit like that could really impair the administration of elections. It could impair confidence in elections. And I just don't know that that would be appropriate to automatically say that a state legislator would have standing to be able to go and sue like that. And by the same token, just an individual voter to be able to do that. I mean, you know, we get all kinds of lawsuits. I mean, in fact, there's one of now deceased liberal attorney here in town who I liked, but he walked up to me one day at lunch and very loudly proclaimed, he said, my favorite defendant, you know, and so he, you know, it loves suing.
Was that Durham who just passed away last
no,
week?
No, it wasn't. No, okay. No, it wasn't. So, but he greeted me that way. And that's just something we joked about over the years is there's a lot of people that are always looking for a reason to sue. And so the more opportunity you give people with the extremes to do that really could further even gum up the system because, you know, I tell you, the last 4 years, we've been inundated with public records requests and open records requests. And to the point where they're so voluminous at times, you know, we had to say last year, gosh, it was 2022 and now it continues in 24, is, hey, we're trying to run an election. And you're pressuring us to come up with documents from 4 years ago. And at some point, we got to move forward and be able to conduct the election.
Yeah.
So there are things like that Heritage might find important that just aren't necessarily on our radar screen. And we're just not going to get some of those points.
Okay. The only other ding was 1 out of 3 for restrictions of private funding of election officials or government agencies. The state does not allow the private funding of election officials and government agencies. Actually, the answer is yes, partial. Explained this way, Tennessee Code 2-11-114, any acceptance of private funding at the state level must be approved by the Speaker of the Senate and House of Representatives, and any acceptance of private funding at the county level must be approved by the Secretary of State. That's you. Yeah. Cameron Sexton and Jack Johnson, I believe, on the Senate side. Heritage says that's bad. What do you think of the system we have funding election officials?
Well, just in case Lieutenant Governor Randy McNally watches this, so it's really Oops. Lieutenant Governor Randy McNally and Cameron Sexton, and Speaker okay. Sexton. So okay. We're real clear about that. So, you know, I personally could have gone and supported a complete ban. I think the legislature wanted to make sure that there was still some provision in case of an extraordinary circumstance that they left at least a little daylight in there in case we had to be able to accept outside funding. It's been made pretty clear to me by Governor McNally and Speaker Sexton that, Trey, don't bother asking me. We're not going to approve that. And also knowing that I work for the legislature, you know, I'd be really loath to accept those dollars or allow a local community to accept those dollars. And frankly, we probably wouldn't even pass that legislation except for during the 2020 election. You're familiar with the Center for Tech and Civic Life and the money that the Zuckerberg Foundation put into election administration at the state and local level. We told every county commission, our state, 95 county election commissions, look, if you need money for something and you've got an idea and money is the issue, let us know what that is and let's talk about it. And we sent that directive out, and we thought it was a directive. I guess one county at least thought it wasn't a directive, it was a suggestion. And so then at the end of the election, we see this map that Center for Tech and Civic Life has, and they have this blue dot in there. And we're like, how is that possible? We told counties not to take that money. And sure enough, one of our counties, the largest county in the state, Davidson County, had taken some of those dollars from the Center for Tech and Civic Life. And so, you know, we said, let's go ahead and pass a bill to make it harder for that to happen. And so that's the result of what we wound up with. You know, personally, like I said, I could be for an outright ban, but there probably is some wisdom in having a little daylight there just in case something extraordinary happened that we want to take advantage of.
Will those Zuckerbucks be not a bill to be used again in that little blue dot in Nashville this coming election?
Well, I'm not going to approve it. Okay. And I don't think that I'm pretty confident Lieutenant Governor McNally and Speaker Sexton are not going to approve me taking that money, and I'm not going to ask.
Okay. So now you're from Memphis, a very troubled area, Tennessee. We had Benny Smith on here, episode 90, for those of you who like to go back in the archives. He was on the Election Integrity Committee from Shelby County, where Memphis is. He taught us about fractional magic in the voting machines, and now he's on the State Commission, SEC we call it, and not the Securities and Exchange Commission, but it is called the SEC here.
And not the Southeastern Conference either. So
correct. I had to learn that, yes. He discovered that Memphis voting machines were dropping votes in predominantly black districts. He didn't say the machines were hacked statewide, but could be hacked. The seven members of the that are elected by the Tennessee General Assembly are Donna Barrett from Murfreesboro, Judy Blackburn from Morristown, Jimmy Eldridge Jackson, Mike McDonald from Portland, Sekondra Meadows from Chattanooga, Benny Smith from Memphis, and Kent Yount La Follette. Have you worked with them on SEC, and do you think those machines are vulnerable?
I've worked with six of the seven members, and I have to tell you, I don't know Commissioner Smith. I disagree with what he has said.
Okay.
The machines that we use here in Tennessee have been tested by the Election Assistance Commission. We have watched them under duress. And by that, I mean, we are never the first state to use a new election machine. We always go and watch it used somewhere else. And we want to make sure we see it not just in a small local race when there's one candidate running in a race. We want to see it under duress with multiple candidates. The bigger the ballot, the better for us to witness. And so, you know, and for a machine to be used in Tennessee, the State Election Commission has to approve each of those. And a Democrat and Republican both go to witness those machines in action. And so I have confidence in the machines that we use in Tennessee. I had confidence in the old machines. We've now moved, and we received funding at my suggestion to the governor and legislature that for the 2024 election going forward, we're going to have a verified paper audit trail in all 95 counties. Nice. And so we're very proud of that. And it has nothing to do with the old machine being the issue. But I made a decision a few years ago. I told our coordinator of elections, Mark Goins. I said, we're about to be on an island where we're one of the few states that doesn't have a verified paper audit trail, and we're also using old technology. And it's like, if you have an iPhone 5 or an old flip phone, you can make a phone call on that, okay? But if you take your iPhone 5 to the Apple store and tell them you want them to fix it, they kind of look at you and say, yeah, we're not going to fix that. We don't fix those anymore. We're going to sell you a new one. So what we saw is old machines, nobody was servicing those anymore. And so we had to make sure that we got caught up with technology, and we moved to a new voting equipment in all 95 counties around the state.
Very good. Well, tell us about your priorities for the and what you expect in November, like your vote matters.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about that, because as you know, based on your experience, I mean, I'm sitting here the first week of April. In less than 7 months, we're going to be having a presidential election. Early voting starts in roughly 6 months here in Tennessee. And as we get closer to that, the things that I say in a lot of circles are going to be either magnified in a positive or negative way. People are going to assume there's some political bias to us. I created the Your Vote Matters program so that, number one, we want every Tennessean to understand their vote does, in fact, matter. It's how we make our voice heard in our form of government. And second, we want to encourage businesses, nonprofit organizations, churches, what have you, to use their sphere of influence to get people registered to vote, to know when early voting begins. Early voting begins when voter registration deadlines are, what's going to be on their ballot, when election day is, how they can be engaged if they want to be a poll worker, all kinds of really nonpartisan messages that can come from people that you know and trust in your local community. And so we're asking organizations out there to do that. Like the Memphis Grizzlies has been a great partner to us in helping get information out. A lot of chambers of commerce around the state have done that. Nike has been another one that has done that. So a lot of organizations out there are helping us put out good trusted information that's critical to getting people to engage in the political process. And we also want
Is
to make
this a
sure.
reaction to the what I've seen since I've been here at least, and I think it's pretty historical, low voter turnout?
Yeah, it is. You know, frankly, we had about 70% turnout in our last presidential election. You know, and I want that number to be 100%. I want everybody to participate. You know, and from a personal level, you know, we get blamed for that. We don't accept blame for that, but we get blamed for that. And I've talked about it this way. You know, I've been making a lot of speeches around the state trying to encourage people to participate in our Your Vote Matters program. I talk about voter integrity, but I asked people how many of them watch the Super Bowl, and pretty much everybody in the room raised their hand. And I said, let's be real. I said, when you watch the Super Bowl, I said, you are watching that football game to watch two football teams play, and you believe there's going to be a competitive game. I doubt any of you tuned in for the referees. And we're the referees of the election. Nobody tunes in and goes to vote because the Secretary of State thinks they should. They go to vote because there's a party or a candidate, an idea that they are very passionate about. And so we're trying to get people to understand they have the opportunity to participate in their form of government. And they don't go because they're passionate about the Secretary of State. They go because they're passionate about supporting or opposing a candidate or an idea. And
Yeah. There was
we
a
have to
county in
accept that.
Tennessee that had a 4% turnout. So yeah, it is certainly an issue. We got a little bit of time
What
left.
would
I
you say
just
about a
want
4% turnout?
there was a county in is an off well, it was last year, off cycle, not presidential race, had 4% turnout.
Well, and so frankly, I mean, I don't know what's on the ballot in that county. You know, I'm sure I could go back and research that. If you look at lower turnout, it's typically because there are non-competitive races. And, you know, there are some people like probably I'm assuming you and assuming me that it doesn't matter if there's one race on the ballot and that person's unopposed, we're going to go vote. It's just what we do, it's in our DNA. Some people are looking at it thinking that person's going to win. I don't have to go. I've got my child's little league practice. You know, I've got church. I've got things I got to do at work, and they're like, I don't have to go. I don't agree with them feeling that way, but it's their right to do that. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say when you mention 4% turnout a place. If there's one race on the ballot, I'm not completely surprised by that. I don't like it, but you know, not every election is the same.
Yeah, especially if they're happy with that candidate and
Yeah.
and they don't have anything to complain about the next day by not participating. If 96% say, well, they raised my property taxes. Darn those guys. Like, well, did you vote? No. Well, there you go. Okay. So a couple more. Tennessee Business Against Trafficking. How's it
Yeah,
going there?
thank you for the opportunity to talk about that. You know, we recently rolled out a program called the Tennessee Business Trafficking, which really helps businesses engage in the fight against the second fastest growing criminal enterprise in the country, and that's human trafficking. So, what we're going to do is we create a program that businesses can utilize that they can engage in this fight by, number one, helping train their employees and their customers if they want to about how to recognize the signs of human trafficking. And then it's not just important to say, oh, I think I see something wrong. It's then, hey, I see something that I think is wrong. What can I do about that? What should I do about that? And who to contact and, you know how to engage with law enforcement and get information, you know, that's pertinent law enforcement might can use to catch the perpetrators. So We think it's going to be critical in making sure that Tennessee continues to lead in the fight against human trafficking. It also makes sense for us to do that. We have a Safe at Home program, which is an address confidentiality program for those who have been victims of human trafficking, sexual violence, of domestic abuse, domestic violence. So, you know, we have an address confidentiality program. We collect that mail for those individuals so their perpetrators can't use publicly available means to find those individuals. And this is a great example. That's not our mission statement, but that's a place where we saw a void in state government. We felt like we could take our bandwidth and utilize it well, do like everything that we do. We take an idea, we figure out how do we go do it right, we pump it full of steroids and try and do it for the least amount of money possible, and trying to figure out how can we best serve our fellow Tennesseans in ways big and small.
All right. Well, two more if I can squeeze it in. Sure. On June 29th, 2017, the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, which had been created by President Donald Trump on May 11th, requested information on registered voters from all 50 states dating back to 2006. Ouch, I couldn't even do that when I got here to register to vote as a Republican because Washington State is a secret ballot. They get rid of that stuff. Anyway, the states were given until July 14th to respond. On June 30th, Secretary Hargett announced that the state would refuse to provide the requested information to the commission. Good job. You said, although I appreciate the commission's mission to address election-related issues like voter fraud, Tennessee state law does not allow my office to release the voter information requested to the federal commission. State versus federal, big issue almost all the time. Any reflections on that moment in time? You stood up. I think you did the right thing. What do you remember about that?
It was a simple decision for me. I mean, our state law did allow that. I understood why they wanted to do that. You know, I was friends with Chris Kobach, who was, helped head that program up for President Trump, you know, but for me, I mean, I had to follow our law. So it wasn't a really hard decision for me. And I later had a conversation with then Secretary Kobach. And when I shared with him, I said, you know, Chris, I said, had you called me on the front end, I would have told you that we can't give that to you in the way we're asking for it. I mean, ultimately what he wanted to do, they wanted to compare voter information from across the country, you know, similar to how, you know, Eric says they want to do it. And frankly, there's some advantage to being able to have one central place to compare all that voter data to make sure that we don't have duplicate people in the voter rolls. So the problem is, who do you trust to do that? And I don't think none of us have really come up with a great idea about who we all could agree on we can trust to run that type of program. So we've entered into state by state agreements, like we have one with Alabama. We've got one on, I think, about to start in West Virginia, got one with Virginia. We'll work with other states where we're going to have some one-offs. We're comparing voter rolls to make sure we don't have duplicate voters.
Okay. Property tax freeze for seniors. During your time in the Tennessee State House, you co-sponsored Senate Joint Resolution 1, a state constitutional amendment designed to freeze property taxes for senior citizens. The amendment won 83% support from voters in 2006, which I think you won your re-election by 81%. So blowout, good job for you. That must have been a help for that. I'm working with Art Laffer, the guy that got it done in California in the 70s for all property owners, a tax cap. Would you be in favor of that for all home and building owners?
You know, at this time, I think I need more details on it, honestly. I mean, the property tax is the fundamental way, along with the sales tax, that counties and cities provide, you know, achieve the revenue they need to provide the services. And there's an argument out there where people say, well, you ought to cap this at no more than 2% growth each year. I think if you tell a local government that they can only have 2% growth in property tax increases, I think what their inclination is going to be is, well, we don't know what's coming, so we better go ahead and grow it at 2% every year just in case we have a year where we need 4 to 6%. We better keep on doing it. So, you know, that's probably not as simple as it sounds to do. You know, Tennessee is number one in the country. We are the least tax state from a state and local tax burden. So in Tennessee, I don't think we have a problem. I know that there's a lot of other people who want to make sure that we stay on the right side of that, and we keep the trajectory going the right way that encourages people to move here. You know, I'm certainly a low tax person, But I think that idea needs to be fleshed out a lot more.
Okay. I'll be working on that for the next several years, I think. Last one. All Tennessee business owners should be wary of any mailing they receive from third parties offering services provided by our office. Secretary Hargett said these parties are not affiliated with us in any way, and we encourage businesses to report any suspicious activities related to the situation. What's going on with mailings that are, well, sounds like a scam related to the Secretary of State's office?
This is a national issue. I mean, and I've seen a lot of different iterations where they would use something that looked very close to our state seal, or something close to like our TriStar and our flag looks. And now we pass laws to make sure that anything they do, they have to make sure they put a very strong disclaimer on it. But the most recent one that we saw was telling businesses around annual report time, hey, it's time for your annual report, and go ahead and file it here. They charge an exorbitant fee, which in many cases could be well over 100% of what we would charge. And truthfully, that entity will go ahead and they will file it for you. They're just going to charge a lot more than you actually have to pay, and they're going to take you right to our website to go and do it. So we're trying to warn people about that type of scam. And we also have some where they're mailing saying that you need to make sure that you order your certificate of existence. And frankly, you don't usually need a certificate of existence for any reason until you get ready to go borrow money, maybe for a certain business type of business transaction, what have you. And but they'll try and convince you need to have this. So, the bad guys out there are always trying to make a dollar off folks. And we're always having to beat the drum about warning our customers about what opportunities, what services we have that cost you a lot less money and actually what you need.
All right. Can I just get one more question in there?
It's up to you. And you've done a lot of homework here. I'm pretty impressed. I shouldn't say pretty impressed. I am impressed.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm impressed with your answers. Tennessee Library Association said censorship is wrong. Attacking librarians is wrong. The Tennessee Library Association fully supports parents making decisions for their own children, but libraries serve everyone in their communities. It is time to trust librarians to do their job. Approved by the Tennessee Library Association Advisory Council and Executive Board on Friday, June 9th, 2023, the American Library Association stated the following. Tennessee HB 2721 threatens library users' freedom to read and violates our professional values and ethics expressed in the ALA's Library Bill of Rights, Marxist Manifesto. If adopted, the bill would establish parental oversight boards, whose decisions about what others can read, view, and access in the library would be final. You are involved in the library, as I said in your bio. What do you make of this and keeping age-inappropriate materials away from young children as young as kindergarten?
Well, first, I would say if the American Library Association is coming out strong against something, there's a good chance I'm probably for it. So that's, I tend to be on the opposite side of where ALA is. And in fact, what we've told every library in the state is they need to have their own policies that mirror their community standards. And we've discouraged them from just taking the ALA policies and using them as a placeholder and a template. If there's an ALA policy they feel like that matches up with their community standards, okay, I don't think they have to reference ALA. What I want to make sure of, and we've told libraries around the state this, is that you do not need to be showing inappropriate materials and displaying those in areas where children might see those. A library is for everybody. And there are books in the library that I would never think about reading. I mean, frankly, if the library were just for me, there'd be a lot of biographies and religious books and sports and things like that, and political books, things like that. It wouldn't have much sci-fi in it, okay? But it's not just for me. So it's for everybody to try and build a collection. But, one of the things, a conversation I had with the librarian one day, she made this statement to me. She said, I just feel like if somebody requests a book, I ought to go get it for them. And I said, you mean to tell me that you've got the kind of resources that if one person requests that book, you think you ought to go buy it? I said, how about starting a list? Start a request list. I said, and then, maybe if you start seeing four or five people request a book, maybe at that point, it's really time to start considering it. I just think we've got to make sure that librarians understand who their customers are, just like I have to understand who my customer is. We got a lot of great, hardworking librarians in our state who are working to curate a collection that meets those community standards. I just hope they all do, because we forewarned them that if you don't abide by Tennessee law, we will remove you from the regional library system. And we remove you from the regional library system, we can take all the computers that we bought, the networking that we've done, and all the materials out of those libraries. And when we did that, they got a lot of libraries' attention. And I had a few librarians and library board members who bowed up. And I said, if you don't want to be a part of the regional library, that's up to you. I've had a few who threatened to withdraw, but nobody's really taken us up on that because they know I'm right.
Yeah, and the Nashville librarian lost his gig because he wouldn't let Kirk Cameron read his children's book. So there are consequences, and man, that is why I love this state. Secretary Hargett, it was a pleasure getting to know you in your office today. Thank you for your time. We're at the end here, so tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you, and maybe if you're on social media, where they can follow you.
Well, I tell you what, if you really want to, do something to put you to sleep, you can follow me. But look at us on Instagram. We're at TNSec of State. You can do the same thing on Facebook. We have a X account on Twitter. We actually don't use that anymore. Just kind of feel like that's gotten to be the sewer of society. So we don't really use that very much. But also our website's a great source of information, sos.tn.gov. Hope that people will use that to find out more about the services we provide and how we're working for Tennesseans.
Very cool. And what's next for you? Are you going to stay a Secretary of State, or you
Probably we'll
have
have dinner here in about an hour.
a nothing political on the horizon? Okay, we'll keep an eye
I
on it
hope
for
dinner's
sure.
not political.
I hope so too. Only Thanksgiving. All right, we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, first time back live, and I just realized I didn't change my shirt into my cool Tennessee t-shirts. Oh well, next time. Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show. Producer Steve, what do you think of our guest, Secretary of State Hargett?
Oh, I love it. And he answered, you just kept hammering away on those secure ballots, secure voting processes. And he answered very well. And he talked about the challenges. And man, I didn't realize there was a movement of people going, hey, we want records all the way back to 2006 or whatever. That would be a headache, Steve. If you told me, Steve, I need a copy of everything you've done for the last 10 years, I'm like, I don't think you're going to get that from me at all.
Not in a timely fashion. No, maybe in the next 40 years, like Pfizer's drug testing or whatever. But yeah, no, he's great. And I just really wanted to sort of not spend too much time comparing and contrasting Washington to Tennessee, because that's not a Washington show anymore. But man, they are polar opposites. And I'm really happy to be right where I am for the next election coming up, because at least I know my vote has a high likelihood of being actually what I
Yes.
voted for, and
Yeah.
not used in somebody else's system, like with Eric,
He even
because
knew who
we're
Hobbs
dragging
was.
and dropping Arizona. He knew who Steve Hobbs is.
Yeah, he mentioned it. I think he said
Yeah,
he.
because they're in that group of 50. So yeah, he did. And he also knew who Kim Wyman was, who
That's
is
right.
the devil. Okay. This from Emerald Robinson. I'm kind of a fanboy, not gonna lie, not just because she's gorgeous, you can look her up on Google, but because she's brilliant and says things like this. Clip number one.
Why not?
Your article on Substack, congressional oversight of these payments essentially are not congressional, but just oversight in general since 2005. So that asks begs the question, why is there not congressional oversight of these payments? I know the issue has been raised. I know that whistleblowers have tried to reach out to the government since that well predates COVID because they had worked with Fauci during the AIDS epidemic and they felt that there was some pay for play with some of the drugs there and they were very concerned. So how has this escaped congressional oversight for so long?
Well, Congress needs to crack down, but I think you need a new Congress to do it because I don't think the current Nancy Pelosi majorities are going to open the books on this potentially unholy alliance between big pharma and big government over at NIH. Emerald, think about this. Every single year, NIH doles out $32 billion in grant making to 56,000 grant recipients. So each year, tens of billions of dollars are going out the door. That's taxpayer money to fund scientific research. Now, for the first time in 17 years, we know how much money is coming back into government, into the scientists themselves, from big pharma, from these big corporations. And it's tens of millions of dollars. You got tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money going out. You got tens of millions of dollars coming back to enrich the agency and its scientists. And we need to shine a white hot spotlight on this and open the books completely on the details, which they're obscuring.
Yeah, we do.
All right. So she wrote this on her Substack last week. The Uniparty's last-ditch plan to stop Trump. The GOP Democrat establishment has hatched a plan to nullify the 2024 elections. Emerald Robinson, April 9th. Marjorie Taylor Greene's April 9th filing of a motion to vacate the chair, a dagger aimed at fledgling Speaker Mike Johnson's only 5 months after he assumed control, should not have surprised anyone in Washington. After all, Speaker Johnson's had been given the job with promises attached to his tenure, and Johnson had already broken all of those promises. MTG circulated a five-page public letter to explain her decision, and it's hard to argue with her logic. GOP voters wanted the Biden regime shut down and the southern border closed, so naturally, Speaker Johnson got a Democrat omnibus bill passed that fully funded the Biden regime and did nothing about the border or the debt. That $1.2 trillion omnibus was so obscene that it passed with a majority of Republicans voting against it. In other words, Johnson is already the leader of a GOP-led House that prefers to pass Democrat legislation. That's unacceptable. That's scandalous. That's all the reasons you need to dump Johnson. Since we're dealing with the GOP, of course, the vast majority of them are still pretending that a terrible deal is actually a great deal. Very few House Republicans have shown any interest in backing MTG's motion to vacate, at least publicly. Here's the main point. It was already clear that the GOP had totally failed its own voters long before MTG filed her motion on April 9th. Did the GOP punish the Biden regime's FBI? No, the FBI got $220 million for its new headquarters in Johnson's omnibus. Did the GOP secure the border? Of course not. Did the GOP stop taxpayer-funded abortions? Don't be silly. The omnibus provided $2 million for more abortions. Mike Johnson simply adopted Joe Biden's dream budget and then got it passed over the objections of his own party. What can explain such a breathtaking betrayal? MTG herself had already provided a dark explanation for the sudden transformation of Mike Johnson from conservative Christian into a pawn of the Biden regime in an interview with Tucker Carlson on April 3rd. The complete collapse of Mike Johnson's political principles was so obvious and unexplained that MTG could only guess that he might be blackmailed by the national security state. Here's a portion of the transcript of that interview. Green. But now Mike Johnson has made a complete departure of who he is and what he stands for, and to the point where people are literally asking, is he blackmailed? What is wrong with him? Because he's completely disconnected with what we want. Carlson. Do you think he is being blackmailed? Green, I have no idea. I can't comprehend, Tucker. What radically changed a man? I mean, if we break down the second part of basically an omnibus, let's break that down. So Mike Johnson is pro-life, and the second part of the omnibus, just less than 2 weeks ago, he funded full-term abortion clinics, He funded the trans agenda on children. I mean, how does that even happen from a Christian conservative Republican speaker? He did nothing for the southern border and did nothing to secure the border. And this comes on the heels of Lake and Riley being brutally murdered. This came on the heels of a video that was running on loop on social media where illegal aliens had rushed our border, ran over Texas National Guard, ran over Border Patrol agents in order to invade our country. There were military age men, by the way. He did nothing to secure our border. It's the number one issue in the world. He completely changed who he was, funded the FBI, gave them a brand new building, fully funded the Department of Justice that is persecuting everyone on the right and actually targeting a presidential candidate for election this year, literally trying to put him in jail for the rest of his life. We don't know who Mike Johnson is anymore. Of course, the signs that Mike Johnson was going to be a uniparty shill were evident to close observers in 2023 when he arranged a meeting with one of the most discredited figures in American politics. Why did Speaker Johnson hold a closed-door meeting with Paul Ryan in December 2023? After all, Ryan works for the Clintons at Teneo while directing anti-Trump coverage at Fox News from his seat on its board of directors. You only meet with Paul Ryan if you're interested in destroying President Trump before the 2024 election. You know it's true. In fact, the GOP establishment actually wants to turn control of the House over to Democrats, no matter what voters decide in November. That's not speculation on my part. That's the only logical conclusion for why 5 of 21 retiring Republicans this year have resigned before the end of the term. That's why 4 GOP committee chairs are leaving, including Kathy McMorris Rogers and Mike Gallagher. That's why Ken Buck quit and Kevin McCarthy quit, and then McCarthy's deputy Patrick McHenry, the goofy bow tie guy, he quit too. President Trump is leading at all the national polls, and all these clowns are headed for the exits for no particular reason. The GOP establishment is retiring early to throw Republican control of the House into doubt. And if Democrats take over the House before the next election because of early retirements, they could pass a resolution that would stop a Trump victory in the 2024 election. I'll be talking about that a lot this year. How? By nullifying the electoral vote via the 14th Amendment, determining that Trump was an insurrectionist. That resolution would pass in the Senate too, because Democrats have a slim majority. Are you beginning to understand now? Washington's corrupt uniparty has hatched a plan to nullify the results of the 2024 election if Trump wins, and they're running it right now. There you go, folks. I wish I could do show you the Republican Party is pure as Caesar's wife, and they never do bad policy or the wrong thing and aren't compromised or corrupt in some cases, allegedly, but I cannot. They are flawed humans too, and we all suffer for it. All we can do is vet these people and vote accordingly. But with 20% turnout, I'm afraid we're destined to get more of the same. And when they get tired of picking on Israel, they'll turn on us, lovers of truth. Last thing, epic speech from golf legend Gary Player ahead of the Masters. Clip number 2.
I never forget to mention this. To come to this great country, the United States of America, if you hear, you are so blessed, and you should kiss the ground every day and just appreciate what this country's done for the world, not only for yourselves, but it's about time America started doing more for their own. And I never.
All right. It's about time America started doing more for their own. Stay tuned for my thoughts of the day. All right, time for my quotes for the day, and only ones for the week, so savor them. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to heartlandjournal.com. Just go there and give us your email and zip code. That's it, just those two things, email and zip code, and we'll deliver news right to your inbox for free. How cool is that? I really hope you like it. We work hard on it, and you can join the conversation at Heartland Journal, no A in journal, just Heartland Journal, L on Twitter and Facebook anytime. Elections belong to the people. It's their decision. If they decide to turn their back on the fire and burn their behinds, then they will just have to sit on their blisters. Abraham Lincoln. Democracy cannot succeed unless those who express their choice are prepared to choose wisely. The real safeguard of democracy, therefore, is education. Franklin D. Roosevelt. A vote is like a rifle. Its uselessness depends upon the character of the user. Theodore Roosevelt, FDR's cousin, the one he didn't marry. A man without a vote is a man without protection. Lyndon B. Johnson. Didn't work for him. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. Martin Luther King Jr. The ignorance of one voter in a democracy impairs the security of all. John F. Kennedy. One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Plato. That's it for this episode. Thank you, Trey Hargett, for your service and keeping Tennessee at the top of election integrity in the country. With so much fraud running rampant, we've got at least one state less to worry about. That is goodbye for now. I am your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of HeartlandJournal.com. See y'all next week. Peace in our time, and definitely glory to God. I think we have a bonus for you again today. Stay tuned for my reminiscences of the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson, and how close to home the OJ news and trial hit me while I was on the Matt Murphy Show. Yeah, I've been dreaming.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.
Hour from now, I don't mean to laugh when I say this, but about an hour from now, we will hear from Representative Gino Bolso. If you have not heard, there was a piece of legislation that passed in the House today that would prevent first cousins from marrying. Tennessee House and Senate Democrat Representative Darren Jernigan and Senator Jeff Yarborough introduced a bill to ban marriages by biological first cousins. It's my understanding, I'm just looking at the sheet here. It was sent to me. Thank you for my contact down there. It passed pretty overwhelmingly. It passed 75, this bill by Jernigan, Senate Bill 1917, on third consideration, passed the House of Representatives. The ayes were 75, nays were 2, present not voting 9, not voting 13. So only 2 people voted against this. And one of them was Gino Bolso. And he put up a fight about it. We will speak to Gino Bolso at 2:35 about this. In the meantime, our good friend Steve Abramowitz of Heartland Journal joins us. We've been talking about OJ and Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson, all the memories that that brings back. I mean, it was an era in time, the mid-1990s. I can remember like yesterday where I was when the chase happened. I can remember like yesterday where I was when the verdict was read. Could not believe it. Could not believe it, even with everything involvement in that case. Couldn't believe that O.J. Simpson was walking away from what I consider to be double homicide. Steve Abramowitz, our good friend, calls in to discuss said same. Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. How's Heartland Journal?
It's doing very, very well. Very, very well. We've been launched now for 2 weeks, and the clicks keep coming, so we're proud of it.
For those who have missed it, perhaps out of pocket for some time, Steve obviously is a part of Mill Creek View, Tennessee for years. Mill Creek View, Tennessee is now Heartland Journal. Absolutely love it. Love the name. Love the branding. It's all about the heartland with you and with me and with the good people of Tennessee. So I'm glad that it's going well, Steve.
And we had Senator Janice Bowling on yesterday to tell us all about what you were talking about. We did not talk about cousins marrying, but she's been around a long time and knows a lot of things about why Tennessee is so great. So great show. Check that out.
I like Janice Bowling a lot, and I will be checking it out. I've got a little drive to take after the show today, and I might just pop on the old Heartland Journal on the podcast and let Abramowitz take me on my way. How about that?
Love it. Love it. Love it more than anything.
So you have memories of, you mentioned to me via text, you have memories of OJ and that era in time. Where were you back then?
Venice Beach, California, right there, local news. My roommate was Ron Goldman's girlfriend. So
what?
When the what? News, oh, yes, sir. What? Yeah. When the news break and everyone said, oh, it was doing a vengeance jealousy thing with an affair I knew day one. No, that's not true. And so it became local news because Brentwood is very small. And for the next 4 or 5 years, we had to deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome and all the rest because it was devastating, quite devastating.
So it was long told to us. I mean, there was some misinformation that came out right at the beginning that Ron Goldman might have had some sort of intimate relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson. But then we found out later that he was a waiter at a restaurant. He was returning like glasses or something to her. Is that not right?
That's right. She left her glasses behind, place that we all frequented all the time, and he brought them to her on his way home. No big deal. And wrong place, wrong time. The rest of the evidence is pretty self-evident. But yeah, he He actually, on the plane home from Chicago in L.A., he told a seatmate that there were two bodies. But when he was notified by the police, they only said a murder took place on your property. They never said that. So that was the guilty conscience moments of him. I did want to mention one thing, too, and I remember it like yesterday. The defense team was a dream team, no question about it. You come up against that buzzsaw, you're going to make it's going to be really hard to prove anything. But Marsha Clark, who was really, really good at her job, was denied the last day of evidence when they interviewed his maid. She wasn't there. She actually had to do for being a mom, and that really probably would have been the under cross-examination a really silver bullet in the prosecution. So there was so much going on between Ito being a TV hog and wanting all the attention, and then, of course, Cochran doing all of his wonderful things. It was the trial of the century, but it was also the farce of the century.
I certainly agree with that. I had no idea, Steve. I mean, I know you've been around, man, but I had no idea how intimately knowledgeable and really in some way involved, considering. So Steve Abramowitz tells us that you were rooming with the girlfriend of Ronald Goldman at the time that he died, and you were just right there in the midst of it. What was it like to be in the – I mean, we understand I was in Carrollton, Georgia at the time. Most people could put themselves where they were at the time that all of this went down. What was it like to be in the epicenter?
It was terrible because his sister and his father were obviously the victims as much as the Simpson family. They had to sue civilly to actually get discovery of all the truth, which they won, but you know, he never paid. But he did keep a promise. He said he was going to pursue the killer to the gates of hell, and I guess he just followed him yesterday. It was terrible. I mean, think of it like a friend of the family being completely slaughtered, and then you have to go through the 24/7 news cycle. Cable news was actually brand new back then, to see it over and over and over again with this rumor and this rumor and the fancy shoes in the puddles of blood. Well, that blood they're talking about was Ron's blood, or the fibers on his clothes or his hat. That was Ron's fibers. So you're talking about a friend slaughtered. And again, wrong place, wrong time. Didn't have anything to do with the reasons why he would kill his wife.
Man, oh man, what a fascinating time that was. I mean,
But here's another thing I want to make sure to say, and I don't want your whole show, but Kardashian, aside from unleashing his daughters on us for the next 40 years, he was on video carrying a Versace bag out of OJ's house and denied it. The 15-inch knife was never discovered. There's probably something like that. So when you talk about defense attorneys being, you know, doing their job and holier than thou and like Michael Crichton movie, not always. Some of the times these guys are just bad dudes. Rest in peace.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah, sure. And never proven necessarily whether he did anything that would have risen to the level of impropriety. I'm talking about Kardashian now, but obviously there is a belief that OJ got help to eliminate the evidence that was against him, and that he everybody believes that he dropped the bloody glove. He went over the fence because he couldn't go through the front door because the limo driver was already there. And that he had to get the bloody clothes somewhere. There's, speculation that he took them on the plane with him. There's speculation. And, frankly, you could have done this in 1994, Steve, speculation that he might have taken the knife with him on the plane and then disposed of it in Chicago. And I've heard the rumor mill or the speculation that in the aftermath while he was in Chicago that he got good close confidants to help him dispose of some of that material.
Well, remember he had Cato Kalin living on the thing and they found some stuff on the property. I mean, there's a lot of that, but the one that was actually tested was the one that was in the Versace bag. And it's actually probably not Versace. I can't remember my fashion designers off the top of my head, but it doesn't really matter. but that's the one that Kardashian walked out of and played dumb about, oh, well, you know, even though I'm a brilliant lawyer, I didn't realize that that might have been evidence. So,
yeah. Well, no, it's incredible. I said this morning when I found out, I'm sorry, not sorry. I don't have any thoughts. I don't care. I mean, OJ's dead, and I believe that a killer has died, has left the earth, and based on his lack of remorse, I don't really have any remorse for him. Maybe I should. Maybe I'm not as faithful as I should be. But
no, and I called because of the Goldman family, who I love, and I feel bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
The media, especially in L.A., and the police and everybody else covered this up so much. But, you know, Barbara Walters did interview Kardashian, and he does talk about this bag that I'm talking about. So it's not as if I'm making it up and there's no evidence. But Shapiro, Cochran, the Dream Team, highly paid guns, Dershowitz, there was no way that he wasn't. But that's what's amazing, is that the civil trial is where everything actually came out, the reason why we even know all these details. Those guys weren't involved in that. And the reason why the Kardashians and the Simpsons had the falling out is because he couldn't actually pay them for all that they did. And if you ever watch that verdict, you could actually see it as a Giphy, I think. Kardashian's face just drops. Like, he couldn't even believe that they said not guilty. And so, of course, you asked the question about what the Bronco was going. He was leaving the country. He had $9,000 of cash in there, and he talked about killing himself because, you know, innocent people do that.
Right. And I'm a little harder on the prosecution than you've been, because they just botched from the beginning. They botched so much of that case, and sadly, they seem to be underwater from the beginning.
People can't relate. Maybe you can, because you spent some time in Birmingham, but people can't relate how in L.A. in 1991, all the way up through that trial, the aftermath of the Rodney King was so negative and such a, like, I remember getting in an elevator and going, is this it? We're throwing down? Like, you just had no idea how racialist, and the majority of the women on that jury were black women. And for some reason, Marsha Clark thought, she even got a perm. She thought she, like, was in it with the lady. Like, they totally got her. But in reality, they hated her because she was a woman who was perceived as the B word and very rough. And so those boys, those gentlemen, OJ included, got to play, oh, I'm the victim. They're trying to railroad me like they did Rodney King. I mean, it really did have a psychological impact. And it's probably felt to this day.
It worked. No, it was almost the beginning of wokeism, if you think about it, in that OJ Simpson allowed his Dream Team, and the Dream Team used a racial divide that was largely healing in America. They redivided the country on racial lines, and they used the sins of our country's past as excuse making to get OJ off. They really did.
They did, and the police chief of LA at the time, he was a very, very strict Ramparts Division type of guy. If you've ever seen the movie Colors, trying to deal with the gang violence, all those kind of things. So there really was a sense of it was the police against the people, especially in the inner cities where I lived. South Central LA is where my college is. And so I literally got to see how, especially after Rodney King, the police were the enemy. So this is the pre-defund the police movement. This is the post-Vietnam War. We don't like the military. Now we don't like the police after 9/11 thing. And then they played that up right there by saying, oh, we ran out of physical evidence to prove he's innocent because he's not. Let's now make it he's a the police planted it. They planted that glove.
I remember.
They planted all this evidence.
DNA evidence, all of these things. They planted it. I remember. They took the blood out of the evidence room, and it had chemical. Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday. Real quick before we go, Todd writes in and says, hey, Matt, did you ever apologize to Steve for being wrong about the census?
Can I clarify one thing about that?
Yeah, sure.
You can apologize if you want to, but there were two census conversations in one. So
we were talking about two different things. Yeah,
right. One is trying to get a little town that's growing really fast, top 10 in the country, some money to build things like an ice rink. The other one was in 2030, the illegals are going to be counted as heads, and we're going to lose a bunch of representatives in D.C. and dilute guys like Mark Green who try to get the job done. So, right. So you don't have to apologize, but if you want, go ahead. I'll accept it.
Well, and you too. You.
I'm sorry I confused the two issues.
I'm sorry I did too. Bromwich, you know I love you.
Content, I got you content by sending you Haggis.
That's right. It was good. Mayor was really good. So, Steve, thank you. HeartlandJournal.com. For those interested, go there, watch, enjoy the podcast. It's great. Thank you, Steve.
See you soon.
All right, take care. There's Steve Abramowitz. All right, it's one.